welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I am one of your hosts, Tom Donnelly, and we're joined today by the Professor Elder. How are you, sir?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You were in sunny Southern California for a couple weeks, but now you are back in the frozen tundra of the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. Is that correct?
I am. I'm back. I just flew in yesterday.
So how cold is it? How cold is it there?
It's 45 degrees. So it's warmer than when I left. I intentionally, my sister decided to come back for the month of February and give me some relief. So she got hit with all the snowstorms and everything, or the bulk of them. So and kind of the coldest weather. So it's hopefully we're on the upside now.
I just hear 45 degrees, and if it was that temperature in Los Angeles, people would be breaking other people's doors down with shotguns and stealing their supplies.
That's the way it would be. Tragedy.
My God, it's horrible. Long sleeves. We need long sleeves.
Yeah, it's absolutely freezing. I can't deal with it.
But there you're like, oh, it's quite warm today. It's very nice.
I'll tell you, like, being in the 70s and being able to go down to the beach and ride my bike every day, like, it was so nice. Like, I remember when we first got there.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't believe how nice it is. Like, you know, like, I've lived here for all these years, right?
Yeah.
But when that first day when it hit me, when we're sitting on the beach in February, and it's sunny, and I was just like, oh my God, I miss it so much.
Yeah, yesterday was one of those days for me where it used to be every single day I walk out and I go, look how clear the sky is. Look how perfect the temperature is. There's this tiny little breeze that just gives me just a little bit of cooling and everything. It's gorgeous every day. I can't believe it. And then after you've been here a while, you're like, it never rains. You know, it's WandaVision. It's all fake. There's nothing. Right. There's nothing real here. Everything should be brown and dead. But there are still those times. And each year, there's a few less days when you really appreciate how amazing it is. But I still get them. I still get those days when I'm like, oh God, it's really. There really is something, a real pleasure in being able to go out almost every day of the year, and it's just beautiful, right?
Yeah. Well, I made that vow that I would never take it for granted coming from Philadelphia where, you know, growing up it was just gray most of the time.
And oh, yeah.
The type of days that are just commonplace.
Well,
in
I'm
LA,
a Jersey boy, so you know, you and I were,
you and I
grew up within an hour of each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So... Totally agree. This is round 10, turn 9, and we're going to be talking not about Philadelphia, but we're going to be talking about the upcoming 2021 release of Darwin's Journey by Simone Luciani and Nestor Mangione, I believe this is how you pronounce his name. And fittingly, we're also going to be talking about the intersection of mechanics and theme, something I think Darwin's Journey does pretty darn well. And we're going to end with our top 5 games that blend mechanics and theme the best. Elder, when you came up with this idea for a topic, I was like, I'm sure we've done it, but we haven't, have we?
Yeah, not specifically. I know we've touched on it before. And again, by the way, I can't believe it's like round 10 already. Ah. But I was looking through the episodes and the discussions, and I was like, wow, yeah, we've never done this one. So this is going to be really cool.
It's amazing. It's going to be wonderful. And I do want to say one thing about Darwin's Journey before we get to it, which is a couple weeks ago we did Carnegie, and we called it a review, and Matt said, I think rightfully, that maybe we should call those early impressions rather than review, because these games are not out yet. And there could be changes. And you never know. There could be very significant changes. There could be slight changes. When we looked at certain games that were very much prototypes, we definitely called them early impressions. But I think any game that is not yet out, that isn't, you know, that isn't finalized, we should call early impressions. So I think we'll call this one early impressions of Darwin's Journey, right?
Yep. I think that sounds good.
Sounds good. Let's get right into this week's game night.
Thank you.
What you been up to lately? What have you been playing, Elder?
Well, just for this past week, just Darwin's Journey. You know, something kind of odd happened a couple weeks ago where I was, you know, I've been playing games during the pandemic, like more often than you know, before, because it's so convenient and TTS and all. And I was, you know, trying to get a game in, at least one game, like kind of every night. And then about 3 weeks ago, I played a game of Darwin's Journey, and I'm not blaming it on the game, but it was a particularly rough game. And I was just like, yeah, I'm going to take a break from playing games. I don't even think I had made the decision, but I just stopped.
Right.
And sure. And yeah, and it's been weeks, and I've been instead during that time frame, I've been watching episodes of 24 with Kiefer Sutherland, like reruns. This is my third time through the series.
That is your comfort. That's your comfort food when times get tough. That's what you turn to, Jack Bauer.
yeah. There's something about it, like it's so intense and over the top that it strangely makes me feel kind of safe and comforted when I watch that show. It's like so weird.
Oh my God, that is so funny. I absolutely love that. I've been playing way less games than I do when we play face to face. Not none. I mean, still playing games, but I don't have the same joy when I'm playing online. Like if I beat you, Elder, and I can't see that little frown that you get when you realize I took the action that you desperately wanted to take, if I don't see that frown, I'm not getting that dopamine hit. I'm not getting that rush. I'm missing something crucial to the experience. And so, you know, that's the way I go. But we are in this weird time where we've been, you know, we've been in a period where, hey, everybody just stay hunkered down, you know, keep your head down, keep your head in the game. Let's all just live through this. We don't know when help is coming, but it's going to be a while. But now that help is right around the corner, man, time seems to slow down, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to. Yeah. We seem to be in this place where it's harder now to wait.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but you can't gauge exactly how far it is.
Yep.
And I think that like we're all just so fatigued.
Yeah.
Of you know, wearing masks and just everything else that comes along with it. That it's just. It's kind of tough, and we don't know exactly when, and then we know that it's going to be different. It's not going to be like how it was before, but we don't know how different. I'm also dealing with, like, am I going to be on the East Coast or the West Coast? I can do all my work virtually. Oh. I mean, I'm pretty certain I'm going to be on the West Coast, but it's really going to be these next several months are going to be about that transition and how it's all going to happen and exactly when and everything. So,
well, we very much hope that you come back to the West Coast, because when we have in-person gaming, we're going to taunt you endlessly until you come back. You realize that's right.
I get it. I don't think I'm going to miss. I don't think I'm going to miss a session. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be back in time.
Awesome. For me, I played Darwin's Journey. A bunch of Darwin's Journey. Loved it. Still playing Terraforming Mars online. I'm really liking the app. It has a few glitches every once in a while, but it's really, really good. And then a couple games with the family. You know, Crokinole is still, you know, you watch Jack Bauer for solace. I play a game of Crokinole with my wife virtually every day. And that is grounding for me. That's really good for the two of us. And then a couple other games brought out. High Society, what a great little filler game that is just such a tough little bidding game. I absolutely love it. We don't talk about it much anymore, but still one of my go-to fillers if ever there was one. And then brought out Jaws again. Have you played Jaws? Because it's so good.
No, I still haven't. I've been hearing you guys rave about it for a while now, and I'm interested. And I remember the one night at live gaming where there was a table playing it, and you know, sure sign of an engaging game is when you hear the screaming happen at a certain action or event that happens in a game, and it was happening constantly. I was like, man, those guys are having fun. I got to try that out.
And we were playing Aura and Labora at the other table.
Mm-hmm.
yep. while they were playing yep. that. And so we're just hunkered down. We're monks, and we're trying to figure out, how do I afford to get the brewery or the chapel or this or the other thing? And we're just caught in our own mind. And then we hear, no, no, not the shark. No, he's not there. Ah! They got Brody's son. Ah! So good. So good. And maybe something that we'll bring up when we talk about the intersection of mechanics and theme. What say we get into the news?
Good evening, Mr. Mr. Nobles, South American, all the tips and clippers at sea. Let's go to press.
The news.
You might be interested in this one, Elder. There is a new Disney game that's going to be coming out based on the popular Saturday morning animated series, Gargoyles. It is going to be coming from Ravensburger. Gargoyles Awakening is going to be a co-op game for 2 to 5 players. Listen, you were an animator before you were anything else, right, Elder? So you must be very familiar with Gargoyles, yes?
Yeah, that's what I went to school for, and that was like my first real profession was animation, so definitely familiar and was a fan of the show. I know there's been a bunch of fans that have been awaiting a revival or a reboot for a long time. So I think it's really interesting to see it come out as a board game. I think that whole, Kickstarter sculpts, like the, great character design on the show.
Yeah.
I know Batman animated series was really popular at the time. And so this is character designs are very similar.
Oh, yeah. 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 Same style of animation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Same style of animation. It was kind of like Disney's answer to it. I just think it's a slam dunk, I think. Even if you weren't familiar with the original show, I think it's going to be very attractive to people and would imagine it's going to look really cool on the table.
Yeah. I never watched the show myself, but I know a lot of people that are huge, huge fans of it. And it's one of those sort of gems of that Saturday morning cartoon of that era. It was like one of the ones that people always, always raved about. This is going to take place on a 3D cityscape. You play one of 6 characters, and there are 4 scenarios in the box. You're going to battle against, villains like Xanatos and Demona. And, goes on sale at Target on August 1st. It's going to cost $35. This is a game that you could probably play with your kids. I think it's going to be very much like Villainous in that sense. It could, which did very, very well, right? Villainous
was
a huge hit.
Yep.
Keep your eye out for Gargoyles Awakening. Next up, if you like video games, Stardew Valley was a very, very popular video game that has now been turned into a board game. Stardew Valley, the board game, is going to be coming out. It is developed by the creator of the video game, Eric Barone, and board game developer Cole Medeiros. He did Web of Spies. He was one of the people who helped design Mafia Wars, Cityville. Good guy, good designer, solid. Did you ever play Stardew Valley?
I did not, but I heard about it, and I know it was a very extremely popular video game, kind of like a breakthrough from, I believe, like a more independent developer.
Yeah.
And just crazy successful, so looks like another smart play to make this into a tabletop, and it looks really pretty.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, I think so, too. Mm-hmm. It is supposedly available for purchase right now. Mm. Not available right now, but boy, oh boy, we could not be more excited about this. Concordia, the digital edition, is coming to Steam. It is going to be coming out in the third quarter of 2021, and from the looks of it, it looks like there's a very good chance that it will have multiple maps, which I think makes a lot of sense. Don't know that for sure. It could just be, it could all be just the base map, but base Concordia, how do you even say the word base when you talk about a game this good, right?
Yeah, amazing. Exactly. And I would think that all of the, they would just put all of the different maps and assets into the game.
Yeah, it should be probably, or at least get, quickly add plugins shortly afterwards where you can add those elements. Because a lot of the expansions, Salsa, for instance, or, some are just a new map, right? No, not even basically any new rules. Those should be fairly easy to program and plop in. So Concordia Digital, third quarter 2021, look out for it. It's going to be great. Still on the video game board game front, Skyrim is about to become a board game. It is going to be announced on the brand new place where crowdfunding site called GameFound. GameFound is going to be a, or is, I guess, a place for crowdfunding in specific tabletop games. It looks like they're also going to have a collector's edition of Robinson Crusoe on that side as well. So that's kind of cool.
Nice.
Right? Yeah. Skyrim. Oh, holy cow. How do you not say yes to Skyrim? I mean, that's a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, that's going to be super successful. I mean, there's so many diehard Skyrim video game players out there that I'm sure a lot of them are the same audience that are into a tabletop game, and they're going to be all over this, even from a collector's standpoint. They're going to this is going to be a multi-million dollar Kickstarter for sure.
I can't see how it's not, right? It's going to be huge, right?
Yeah.
In even happier news, we have a exciting announcement here. Board Game Geek has a new show. It is called Board Game Breakdown, and it is hosted by our own friend of the pod, Candace Harris. And it is a making of series. It is about the making of board games. I've watched the first episode with Elizabeth Hargrave, and it is fantastic. And it's particularly fitting, since it just came out this week, that I am doing this podcast with you, Elder, because when I talked to Candace about this episode, she sent me this lovely little email. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
She said, thank you for promoting Board Game Breakdown, but please mention that Elder is actually the one who initially gave me the idea for the show and has been my sounding board since day one. We meet regularly and chat about our game designs, about Board Game Breakdown, games on our brain, and sometimes even get into playtesting, etc. And he's just been super supportive, always there for me to bounce ideas off of. So I figured it'd be cool to mention since he is part of the Game Brain crew. Thanks, Candace. Thank you, Candace. This is a fantastic show. Thank you, Elder, for being a part of this. It's amazing. Yeah. It's I couldn't believe when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, this really is a making how to make a board game when interviews with some of the great board game designers. Why has there not been a show like this before?
Yeah. We were really surprised when starting the conversation about the concept for the show, because there's other shows with interviews with designers, but most of the time it's like right when they're coming out with the new game, and it's just an overview of whatever that current game is.
Yeah, and it's something that they do occasionally, but it's not the focus of a show, right?
Right. Yeah. It's like it winds up being more about promotion and so forth. Right. And, sometimes there's a question thrown in. How did you come up with the idea? But this is different. This is a show that's completely the entire conversation is specifically about a specific game design with these great, very successful designers. And it's really a deep dive into their process. Mm-hmm. And it's like we just thought it would be so interesting to because we're both, would be kind of amateur casual designers ourselves.
Sure.
And we just thought it would be so interesting to see for instance, prototype. Like there's certain things that are kind of standard when you're designing a board game. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the paper prototype, like your first, getting something to the table. And so everybody has to do that. But the real, I think, kind of like nitty gritty of the show is how each one of these designers does it a little bit differently. Right. And like when they start their first prototype and, what are the different tools that they use and how does that go? And that's where, I mean, just watching that first episode, there were like so many moments where I was just like, man, that's just gold right there.
I thought so, too. I was like, I was blown away. I was like, this is a fantastic show. I mean, it is so different. I mean, it traffic's in the same territory and all that sort of stuff. It doesn't feel like it's remote in any way, shape, or form. It is just the juiciest kind of deep dive into the minds of people creating these games and helps me understand the hobby that I love better. I'm blown away.
Yeah, and that's one thing that we're curious about to see. Like we're pretty certain that the designers will love this show, but we also suspect that just anybody who's a fan of game design, And these, especially the particular games that come up on per episode, or the designers, you know, they're going to love it too. It's just like how people love behind the scenes for, you know, the Marvel movies or Star Wars or anything like that. You know, like that process is the creative process and design process. I think it's just super interesting to look at.
Oh, yeah. Well, it'd be like a foodie who only watches reviews of restaurants and never likes to watch a cooking show.
Right.
No, of
right.
course you like to watch a cooking show. You want to see how it's made. You want to learn exactly. a little bit of something. Absolutely amazing. Congratulations to Candace. Looking forward to watching a lot more of this. And congratulations to you too, Elder. Thank you for supporting the hobby in this way. That was really, really awesome. Yeah. Next up, Cryo. Cryo is competing factions must scavenge the wreckage of their colony ship in order to survive. This is one of those, mission gone wrong, engine building, worker placement games. Looks pretty good. The reason I'm bringing it up, though, is because of the designers. The designers are Tom Jolly and Luke Laurie, which is a crazy combination. Like, Luke Laurie is the designer of, he did Whistle Stop this past year. He did the very, very good Manhattan Project Energy Empire. But Tom Jolly is one of those blasts from the past names who's been game designing, by the way, up until the present. But when I hear the name Tom Jolly, I think original Whiz War in 1983. He was the first, he designed Whiz War, which for, during the 80s was the most played game that I had. I still have my initial edition of it with the cheap cardboard plastic and the cheap paper cards that are basically almost ground to dust at this point. But I'm never selling that copy. That is one of my favorite. When you talk about games that make memories, that game, Whiz War, is the absolute best. And it captures Tom Jolly's spirit, which is he is a serious game designer. He comes up with, he has great ideas, but there's also a sense of fun that he has about everything that he does. I don't think the man could design a dry game if you paid him $1 million to. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. This looks like it has quite a few resources in it too, this game.
Yeah. it does have a few resources, doesn't it? that's the lens through which you view everything. Cryo coming out in 2021 by Z-Man Games. Be on the lookout for it. And then I guess this is definitely the week of spinoffs, because the last two notes are about Funko is turning Fast and Furious into a board game. Fast and Furious Highway Heist is going to be for $30. You're going to get plastic cars. You're going to be trying to do stunts. You can 2 to 4 players, and you can play Dom, Brian, Letty, Roman, or others. And, you know, there will be some dice chucking, so this is not exactly going to be the deepest game you've ever played, probably. But it is a cooperative strategy game, and it is designed by Prospero Hall. And, you know, we have the highest respect for Prospero Hall and what they do. They have really put together a little empire quite recently that has been amazing. Even their games that are more gimmicky, like their Top Gun game, hilarious. Hilarious. These guys have just a wonderful energy about them in terms of the way they approach design.
Yeah, I think they just kind of mastered this recipe of taking these existing IP, which is, again, what they do really well, essentially, yep, is take, you know, well-known themes and come up with great mechanics, which is a tricky thing to do.
Yeah.
But they've seen to, again, they have mastery. They're able to do it over and over and over again. And, I just think it's really, really interesting. And like, you know, like in the video game world, for the industry's been plagued for years with, you know, this kind of curse of having IP and then trying to make a video game mechanics that work with it and having these failures over and over again.
Oh, yeah. Branded content used to mean that the game would be unequivocally bad, right?
Yeah, and even in the board game space, that kind of translated over. But that these guys are able to, again, not only like understand the IP, but and stay true to it, but then also to marry like these like accessible mechanics, game mechanics that could, you know, that kind of satisfy, you know, the Euro gamer as well as the more casual gamer. I mean, I think that's quite a feat. Again, especially to be able to do it repeatedly. Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I you know, I will say that I would normally look at a Fast and Furious game and be like, nope, pass.
Yeah.
The moment it says Prospero Hall, I kind of got to learn more about it. I have to. I'm going to want to try it. Just to see what these mad geniuses are doing. Yep. Anyway, and last but not least, we have Alien: Fate of the Nostromo. Which, I mean, you want to get me even more excited, take Alien and turn that into a board game. You're going to play the game of Alien, the original movie. You're going to have it's a cooperative game in which you are trying to track down this xenomorph and eliminate it before you get eliminated. This one is coming out August 1st, $30. We don't know a ton about it, but man, oh man. Take my money.
Right. Is this also Prospero Hall though? Or?
No, it's this one's a Ravensburger design. So okay. The designer is Scott Rogers. The one thing I don't like about Prospero Hall is that they do not credit their designers.
Mm.
Prospero Hall games are made by Prospero Hall, and they do not name their designers, which I think is a regressive step. I think that the hobby has done a really good job of putting the designer's name on the box, right? And sometimes that's one of the bigger selling points. When Simone Luciani, when Uwe Rosenberg comes out with a game, one of the biggest selling points is their name. And for Prospero Hall not to do that, I think is a mistake. They're designing, you know, they're not designing the heaviest, deepest games in the world, so maybe some forgiveness can be had. But nonetheless, I wish Prospero Hall would name their designers.
Yeah. Man, these sculpts on the Alien game are freaking incredible.
Right?
Very impressive.
Aren't they crazy good?
Yeah. I mean, they look like... I mean, that's so hard to pull off that small. Like, even, you know, 12-inch action figures are difficult to get the likeness, but they... And it's just gorgeous. You could just tell, like, they look like the actors, and the Alien looks amazing, too.
Harry Dean Stanton looks exactly like Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's crazy. And the Alien looks great, too. So I'm very much looking forward to this.
Nice.
That's all we got. So let's move on to Games on the Brain. What's on your brain these days, Elder? What you thinking about?
Well, definitely this week it was, you know, the game we're reviewing, Darwin's Journey.
Sure.
I was thinking about that. I also, I don't think it was this week, but the game, maybe the week before, I played Transcontinental again with Trey and Ben. Trey trounced us, but it was still fun. That's a really interesting game, and it plays so differently, I think, when... You know, playing with different people too.
Totally.
So yeah, I've been thinking about that.
It's pretty good. I've been thinking about a couple things. I've been thinking about there was a I got a what would you call it a patch expansion. It's not an expansion. It's sort of a corrections thing from GMT Games. They sent it out for three different games. They sent it out for Versailles 1919. They sent it out for Imperial Struggle and one other game. I can't remember what the third game is. Well, I have those two games, and looking into the you know, it's correcting things on the board. It's putting out corrections on cards. You know, just cleaning the game up a little bit. It caused me to delve back into Imperial Struggle, which my game of the year. And I haven't played in several months, and I'm just totally on my brain how great that game is. Really looking forward to delving into it. And I can't wait until I can play face-to-face with somebody, because it's just one of those games that I just want to sit with somebody for a few hours and just watch their brain work through the problem and counter every move that they make. It's hard. It's a really, really hard game, and I love it. Absolutely love it. And then the other thing on my brain is Dominant Species Marine. Copies of it are appearing now, and it's one of those games. It was Chad Jensen's last design before he passed. Rest in peace, please. And Dominant Species itself is one of those games that, you know, it's like one of Jennifer's favorite games of all time. But myself and several other of the Game Brain crew, not everybody, but several of us thought that it's a near miss. It's so close to being great, but the nature of the take that element in the game is just a little too. It just wasn't calibrated, at least for our tastes. It wasn't calibrated properly, and too much of the game became that sort of bash the leader and that, you know, just that sniveling about getting bashed so hard. It was just so punitive, that aspect of the game, that it damaged what otherwise was a brilliant design. I'm looking forward to Dominant Species Marine, and looking through looking through everything I've found about the game so far, you know, looking at the reference sheets and rules and so on and so forth, this game maybe answers that. I don't think it answers it in a direct way so much, but I think this might be a game that I'm truly, truly going to love, and I can't wait to get it to the table and play it.
Nice. Definitely curious about it. I remember playing the original Dominant Species a few times, and very interesting game, but not particularly my flavor.
Now, other than the fact that it didn't have 30 resources, what was what was your take on the problem with the game?
Gosh, I just remember being a very long game and not like one that I was particularly having a good time playing. I can't even remember very much about but I think that punitive quality, like I do remember these kind of take that, and you know, Jennifer knows this about me. Like I'm not a conflict game type player.
No,
and I really enjoy that aspect so much.
Yeah,
and it definitely seemed like there was probably more of that in that game. And also, like, I just remember these, like, it was like cards or something where you would have a bunch of your species or whatever on a thing, and like half of them would be gone. And I was just like, okay, I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah. Take that. Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's move into our game review. We are talking about Darwin's Journey today. It's going to be a 2021 release. The designers are Simone Luciani and Nestor Menjon. I hope I said that name right. The artist is Paolo Voto, and the publisher is Thundergriff Games. Elder, what is Darwin's Journey about?
So Darwin's Journey is about you're exploring the Galapagos Islands like Darwin did, and you're finding species to basically prove the theory of evolution, right? And there's a couple different types of species, and so you're moving through these islands and you're collecting them, and then you want to put them in the museum. And at the start of the game, you're getting money, but at the end of the game, you're kind of building up this theory. And the more you can do that, you need the money to kind of, you know, get through the game, but the better you do at the theory is going to score you a lot of points at the end of the game. So kind of timing all that out over the five rounds is kind of really key to mastering the game.
And the victory point track is essentially how far you're rejecting God. Is that what I'm to understand?
Basically.
Okay.
Basically.
Good.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make sure about that.
It's like negative faith points. Like, you know, you get faith points in some games. You want to go the other way here.
Well, let's start off with the obvious. It's a gorgeous game. It is a gorgeous game. We talked about the board just the last time we played it, and there were some people that were saying, Trey in particular was saying that the board is really, really busy, and it is.
Yeah,
that's fair.
I would say it is. It's a lot of this game is a lot of information to take in your first play, especially looking at the board. It's pretty overwhelming, but after two or three plays, it all kind of like settles in. And I think it's, you know, from the particularly I think from the Italians, the two tea games that came out to Kainu and Taiwan Sinsuyu is this kind of like this new design, I think, technique of basically having all the information on the board, on the main player board, including the mechanics and everything, how it works, which I feel like, again, it's a lot of information, but ultimately I think it's nice to be able to not necessarily have to refer to the rule book when all the rules are basically like spelled out in iconography on the board for the most part.
Yeah, I agree. I will say that one of my favorite things about games is that when I go to a convention and I see a game that I've never played before and I look at the board, it's hieroglyphics. It's completely ununderstandable. And I'm like, I don't know what the heck is going on. But 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the rules explanation, suddenly I look at the board and it's as though I read the Rosetta Stone, right? All of a sudden, I understand everything that the board is saying, right? I get it, right? And there may be a few rules that I need to learn, but for the most part, I get it. Darwin's Journey is not that quick a transition from indecipherable to decipherable. Even though all the things are on there, it's got a lot. There's a lot in this game. But at its basis, it's a worker placement game, right?
Yeah.
The interesting thing about it, though, is that these workers are upgradable, and they're upgradable in a very, very interesting way. You start off by drafting three cards. You have a hand of four cards. You're going to keep one, pass, and so on and so forth until you have three cards that you want to start with. And these are your assistants. They're the people that are working with you. And they will be of one of four basic types, right? They will be scribes who write letters home and share information and so on and so forth. They will be scholars who are studying these details. They will be explorers who are going inland on these islands and exploring them, and they will be navigators who are guiding the boat through the Galapagos Islands, right? Each of them will have certain things that they want, and if they get the things that they want, then they have a secret power that they will unlock that's generally a very good bonus that you'll get at one point in the game. But each of these guys, they start with that one specialty, right? The specialty of scholarship, of scribe, of explorer, or of navigator, essentially. I'm not sure if I'm using the correct terms, but you get the idea. Over the course of the game, scholarship actions can allow you to get other seals. So all of a sudden, your navigator isn't just a navigator, but he's a navigator and an explorer. Or he has two seals of navigation, which can allow him to unlock and be able to use more powerful navigation actions that move his ship farther or faster or do more, right? And then even to the point where when you get four seals of on your particular guy, you've unlocked the silver award, right? He is basically... he or she is a much, much better person, and whatever action they take, they get a bonus to that action. They get to do it one extra time sometimes. They get to do it in a slightly different way, which is interesting. It's a good twist on the worker placement because you're not simply placing workers, but you're also making really hard decisions in terms of who am I upgrading as far as my workers go? In what way am I upgrading them? And what is my goal in that upgrading? Is it just to get the bonus on the card that they have? Or is it to make them a person that is going to be able to do A, B, and C?
And which worker, you know, do I use to take this particular action this round? Because sometimes you're upgrading, so you don't want to use that worker because you want to use them for a particular or a more powerful action.
Yes.
And it's really well done. I've seen this mechanic in a few other games. I think there's a game called Chimera Station, where, you know, it's like this kind of alien theme and you're putting these different pieces onto your worker placement meeple. But it just didn't feel like it was executed as well. Feels kind of clumsy. But this thing with the seals and the choices that you make and how you build these workers interweaves with the rest of the game, I think is just really, really well done.
I thought so too. Yeah, Caverna is another game in which you can you take your workers and you can upgrade them in terms of mm-hmm. the level of adventurer that they are. But those are still much more basic than this. This isn't just a sliding scale of power. This is a variety of different effects by depending on which seals you're adding to each individual character, which is cool.
Yeah, and then the seals, you know, give in-game scoring, like how well. Like I've seen certain games where, you know, people did the players did a really great job of, like, I mean, I think one player really focused on it one game and they were able to get full seals for all of their meeples, which I think is super impressive to do.
Wow.
I don't know if that won in the game. I don't think it did. But, I mean, you can. That's one of the things you have to kind of balance out and decide, like, how, you know, do you have a couple of your workers have a couple seals, or do you focus on one worker to get them, you know, all the way to the gold level? You only have 5 rounds to do it. Getting seals is kind of hard and expensive. You know, it just makes for some really meaty, interesting choices in the game.
Yeah, and what you're doing in the game by so the top part of the board are journals. And the journals mm-hmm. are just action selection spaces. And at the beginning of the game, each journal has 3 spaces on it. The first space is open and available for business, for somebody to go to. The second and third space are not available yet, but they will be able to be unlocked. There's a character action where you can place one of your workers to unlock another space, and that is unlocking more and more powerful actions the further down you go. There's a couple changes to that in terms of there's two journals that have tiles that go on there, so they change every game in terms of what they unlock, and those don't necessarily scale because it's random what goes down there. But which we'll get to a point. There's something I want to bring up about that I'm not crazy about, which is there's a certain level of fiddliness to the design as it currently stands, that there are more exceptions than there maybe need to be in the game in a few ways, but. But placing these workers out are going to allow you to do those 4 things. And the 4 things are get more seals, which means upgrading your people. And upgrading your people is a valuable thing because in some ways, when you upgrade a person, you're essentially giving them an action and a third, an action and a half. And later in the game, these guys are taking the equivalent of 2 actions per turn because their actions are more powerful because they've been upgraded. That can happen. The letters aspect of the game is sort of an area majority thing. There are 3 places that you can send the letters, and those are going to give you victory points, or they're going to give you resources that you're going to want very much in the game. And depending on how many letters you have in these areas, the person with the most letters in each area is going to get a big benefit, and the second most is going to get a smaller benefit. And then navigation is moving your ship. And at the start of the game, we can explore just one island. But as we move our ship, if we move it far enough, we can explore a second and then even a third island. And those islands are different in nature, right? They have different focuses to some degree. The third island has a lot of victory points on it. You're literally unlocking just point grabs every time you take an action like that, correct?
Yep, yep.
Which is interesting. So tell us about the species collection, because that's the real, I think for most games, that's going to be the main point collector. How does that work, and how does the museum work?
Yeah, so also with the explore action, which moves your meeple around the island. And one more thing to mention about the navigation, moving your ship, mm-hmm. is it's also end of round scoring.
Oh,
right,
yes,
like
yes.
Where your ship is in relationship to the HMS Beagle or Darwin ship determines, you know, there's a specific goal at the end of each round, so it determines if you get full points or if you get less than full points if your ship is where his is or further. But yeah, on the islands, how you collect specimens is there's a place on your player board that has all of the specimens on it, and as you move through the island, so this is another, and again, I think this game does this really well. Like, there's a lot of games that have variable setups.
Mm-hmm.
But we already mentioned the special actions that you can take. Another thing is the objectives I just mentioned at the end of each round. Those are different, and random each game. And then the other thing is where the different specimens show up on the islands. And that kind of combination of, flower specimens are important in this game towards the end. And right. Can you get your guy to all of them, I think, is really key. But you move your meeple around with the explorer action and you land on those specimens. And it's important to note that not more than one player can be on a specific spot on the islands at a time. So you can kind of block other players. Like if you find a specimen, you can kind of sit your meeple there and nobody else will be able to collect it unless they use another action. But when you land on it, you get to basically discover that specimen. You take a little dome piece and put it to show that you've done it. And then it's ready to go in the museum. The other thing to look out for, which I think is a kind of neat thing in the game, and it's a little bit of take that, but not, I don't think it's definitely something you can avoid happening, is if somebody else, if you do move your meeple off, or again somebody does get the same specimen you have, it's a bit of a race to get to the museum to score either the combination of money and not moving up on a knowledge track when you take that action,
which is interesting because at the beginning of the game, when there's nothing in the museum, when you put a fossil or a specimen into the museum, it's going to score you a lot of money, a lot of money, and money is very tight in this game. Mm-hmm. But as the museum starts to fill up, every other time you do it, the next time you do it, you're getting less money, but you're getting more points on the knowledge track. And the knowledge track is essentially a multiplier. You're going to be multiplying how well everybody did filling in the museum, multiplied by how far you are up that knowledge track. And there'll be like times 4, times 6, times 8, times 15, and so on and so forth, depending upon how far you can get up there. And that can end up being a lot of endgame victory points.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good. It should be, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Thematically, you're gathering species, you're gathering knowledge, and the person who wins Darwin's Journey should be the person that did the best job of that.
Exactly. Who contributed to, again, it's taking these specimens, putting them in the museum for everyone else, to see and take advantage of. And there's even an action space where you can go and study a specimen that somebody else put in the museum, which I think again just adds to how well the theme meets the mechanics there.
And it does. It feels like when I play this game, it feels like I am a researcher, a scientist who is exploring these islands that I've never seen them before, and is coming back with all of these samples of these amazing things and comparing them to the other and then putting them in the museum and getting more money to go back out and find more or gaining knowledge in leaps and bounds because I'm putting together connections between this species and that species. It feels, when I play this game, like I am a scientist in the era of Charles Darwin, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels really good. It just works really well, design-wise, all the way around.
Yeah. So, issues. So, one of my issues is that I do think that there are a lot of little sort of niggling rules. Like, the game isn't as intuitive as I'd like it to be. There's a bunch of things where, well, in this situation, this is the rule, but down here, that's not the rule anymore. It follows a slightly different thing. So maybe just a bit too much in terms of the, I guess in war games we'd call it chrome, but in this case we just call it rule exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not a lot.
Yeah. Not a lot. I think once you know the game, it's pretty easy to manage. I think easier than other games. One of the issues I have which it really depends on the game if it comes up. Mm-hmm. But that placement of the when you take the correspondence action and take and place your stamps, you can really get screwed. You know, I think it's a great way to take kind of bonus or extra actions, mm-hmm. but like there's certain things you could do, like, you know, if you place a camp, there's other ways that you could get additional stamps. And right. if you've kind of like banked on, you know, getting something because you have the majority of stamps on these places, especially if you really need it in the game, and then somebody at the very end comes along and puts more than you, and then you can't get it or you get less of it, you can get really kind of screwed. And I don't really like that part of the game. I kind of feel like there needs to be like a cutoff, you know, yeah. but it's I chalk it up to how the game works, and it's not horrible for me. It's not like a game breaker. Like, it's just something that's a little bit annoying, doesn't happen all the time. But, you know, if I did have to point to an issue in a game that I'm, you know, if you haven't been able to tell so far, I'm really a fan of and think it's a really awesome design, that would be it probably.
Yeah, of the people that I've played it with, I'm the biggest fan of it, except for you. Mm-hmm. So we should say that some of the game brainers that we've played this with have been less enthusiastic. Not necessarily negative on the game, but less enthusiastic, yeah. I think is fair to say. I'll say that I'm not sure the timing of the game works out that well. I think at different player counts, I think the museum gets filled up well before the game is completely over. That's a problem. I think that's a problem for me. I think that the ending is a little maybe anticlimactic, and maybe the game overstays its welcome a little bit. That's definitely a possibility. Once again, this is not a full review. This is early impressions from us. Yep. So, but that's where we're at. I'll also say that this is probably the heaviest game the Italian cadre of designers has put out. I feel like this is. This is approaching, this is approaching some of the heavier designs, and I think a lot of what these Italian designers have done is they've made medium heavy games. I think this is probably closer to a full heavy game.
Yeah. I think we both agreed, although other game brainers did not, that this, I don't know if it feels like a Lacerda, but has almost the level of complexity, maybe baroqueness to a certain level. It's if it's not there, it's getting there. I mean, yeah. It is a pretty complex, and really, I think it's more about the interlocking mechanisms and how many of, you know, kind of dials and levers you need to watch to really play the game effectively.
Yeah, it's not like a Lacerda design exactly, but it's on the road toward there. That's for sure. As far as what these guys do, It looks good to me. I very much enjoy it. I think it has so many hard choices. Every time it's my turn to go, I'm almost, the game may take longer than it should because I really, Trey said this, that he would love to play this async so that he could sit there and really think about it before he made his decision. And that would, in some games, every once in a while, they'll have to make that hard decision. Yeah. In this game, all the time you're making that. You have that trouble, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I remember there was one TTS player who, you put up the request that you want to play a game or whatever, and I just remember him making a comment, I just don't want to sit down. I don't know what I want to play, but I don't want to sit down to a 3 to 4 hour AP session, which, you know, again, like your first couple plays is a lot of information, and the decisions can be pretty agonizing, but I feel like in a very sweet way, in this game, I really love the decision space. And this is the same team of designers at Borders Barrage, which, you know, we're all, I think pretty much all the game brainers are a big fan of.
Oh yeah.
But I feel like, where Barrage, I'm as much as I love the game, I'm actually often a little hesitant or nearly afraid to play because I still feel like I'm not very good at the game, and it can be so punishing if you make the wrong move early on. Whereas I feel like this game scratches a similar itch. I feel like it's really good design, really unique and thematic. And it's not that punishing. Like you can recover in the game, and there's plenty of room to stay competitive. There definitely can be a runaway leader at some point, as we experienced in the game we played last.
Let's say that there is a promo card that is not meant to be played with, that we played with.
yeah. Although I've seen people lose with that card. Like, I mean, it's...
How?
Literally, I know. But this is the thing with the game, though. Like, I feel like, that we're talking about Darwin, right? So this is where you basically get the special worker. He is gold and silver, because he has basically six purple seals, which we didn't mention. You can get these permanent seals that are wild. So he has them.
So the greatest worker that one would ever be able to have in the game, better than anything you could ever have, can do anything, can go anywhere.
Yep.
And the unlocking that special power is easier than unlocking any of the other special powers, some of which are take 7 coins, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's crazy.
So no.
now the thing is, though, in the that's also the Darwin is one of the special actions.
Yeah.
So it can be nerfed quite a bit. You can only use this very powerful action character.
Right.
Plus, it gives you an additional action in a round too, which is like another benefit, right? But you can only do it. At most 4 times during the game, and if somebody else takes that special action, then that's going to completely negate it, because there can only be one Dharma placement per round, so it can be nerfed.
You've heard what I have to say about that.
I got it.
Anyway,
I'm not defending it.
No. Darwin's Journey is a fascinating design. It's greatly thematic, which sometimes is something that the Italian designers do very, very well, and sometimes is not really in their strength. But this game feels as though a lot of what the game is designed to do is designed around a situation in which the mechanics are really feeding into the theme. Mm-hmm. Which brings us to our topic. Darwin's Journey is going to be coming out later in 2021, and be on the lookout for it. We think it could be something really, really special.
Yeah. I'm also, this one final note on Darwin's Journey is they had a very successful Kickstarter campaign. I backed it. I think this is one of those cases where I think this has started to be an issue or an argument of do you or don't you put your game on Tabletop Simulator for free when you're promoting it, when you're kickstarting it, trying to sell it? There's lots of varying opinions about this, but I think this is a great example of, it was out, it was an official mod, they promoted it, and they still did a very, very successful Kickstarter. I mean, we know that these are designers that have a lot of fans out there and have a nice track record, so that definitely feed it the success, I think. But again, it definitely can't be done. They had a tournament, which sadly I didn't get around to getting to be a part of, but has some really unique kind of like promotions. And the last thing I want to say is they unlocked a lot of additional content, for which I think is very smart in the business model. So you get the base game on TTS for free, but if you want to get all the additional, cards, all the mechanics, all the additional expansion content, that's going to come with the game, which I'm very looking forward to when the game comes out. It'll be, quite a long time since being introduced and kind of like the initial energy and fondness of the game to get it on the table with people and play with all this kind of like new expansion content.
Yeah. And I personally think that, Kickstarter does a lot of great things for our hobby, but the add-on bonus content thing, I'm not a fan of. I think it often tends to be a sales tool that weakens designs and feeds bad impulses in terms of game design. But I hope that this one is the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
And there have certainly been Kickstarter add-ons that have been amazing, but there are also plenty that are just like, oh, they should not have put that in there.
Right.
Moving on, let's talk about mechanics and theme. Elder, start us off. Tell us what we're talking about. Define your term, sir.
Yeah, so, had this thought coming into this episode about, when you play a game, I think generally in our Euro games, right, the kind of games that we like, the mm-hmm. medium to have in Euros, we talk a lot about, the theme doesn't matter. I think a lot of these games kind of boil down to interactive math puzzles, right, where you're kind of min-maxing,
yep.
Being the most, whoever does the best at managing your resources, accomplishing things with the most economic of moves, mm-hmm. Whoever does that the best in the puzzle will win the game. And a lot of times the theme doesn't matter, right? We talk a lot about the theme being pasted on, right? It's
yeah.
just like, it might be a good game, but you wouldn't know, or you wouldn't have the feeling what the theme or the story of the theme is kind of telling you.
And sometimes that's, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Some of our
yeah.
favorite games in Game Brain are games that have a tacked on theme. Lorenzo, yeah. Il Magnifico.
Yeah,
completely tacked on theme. Nothing in the game, nothing in the mechanics of the game says that this has anything to do with Lorenzo Il Magnifico at all.
Right.
It could have been any other theme and been fine, but it's such a good game. We absolutely yeah. love it.
Yeah. And again, I would say most medium to heavy Euros are in this case. I would probably say, if I had to wage a guess, like somewhere like 75-80%. it doesn't really matter what the theme is or the theme is pasted on, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe. I do think that sometimes the theme is something that fits well within the game. It could be a totally different theme and still work, but mm-hmm. I do think that there are a lot of games where a good theme pulls me into the game and makes me understand the rules of the game and the mechanics of the game in a intuitive way, as opposed to a I have to memorize how this works way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another great point, right? Like in this marriage of themes and mechanics, as I know, again, I've played many, many a game with you, and you're an excellent teacher of games, of the rules. And I think given what you do and your love for story and crafting story, you explain games in a very story driven way.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. Listen, I think you and I think we've taught each other probably a similar number of games over our lifetime. You've taught me tons and tons of games, and you
yep.
come at it from a game design standpoint where you're teaching how the clockwork works.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a really good way to do it. It's just we have very different styles of teaching, but I think they both come to the same result through different means.
Right. And I like to employ that tactic as well. Like, I really enjoy, because I feel like, to your point, when you add story or when you use the theme to kind of explain the story to a player that's learning the game, mm-hmm. it just helps to remember it.
Oh yeah, totally,
yeah.
totally, and you yeah. do a very good job of that too.
Yeah, yeah, well, so yeah, it's from a design point of view, again, I think when you sit down to design a game, we often talk about this idea of, well, what do you do first, right? Like, when you come up with the concept of a game,
mm-hmm.
do you come up with a theme and try to come up with mechanics that match the theme, or do you come up with the mechanics and then figure out a theme that goes with it? And there's definitely no right or wrong way to do it. Mm-hmm. I think you could be a designer that does it all, makes all your games one way or the other. I think you could mm-hmm. mix it up. I don't think doing one or the other first is going to determine whether you ultimately make a good game or not. It's really like a kind of like a first step. I personally am a big fan of theme, although I love mechanics in a game. It would be very difficult, I think, for me to try to purely come up with the mechanics without thinking of the theme. You know, it might be kind of like together, but I'm definitely more of a theme person first. Like, let me find a really cool theme that excites me, and then let me see if I can come up with some mechanics that that match that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have not designed a game other than a LARP, but in terms of designing a board game, whenever I've, you know, as a thought exercise, said, oh, you know, maybe I have an idea for a game, I tend to come very much from theme first. But when I do try to come from mechanic first, it's almost always, hey, this is a great mechanic that very, very few games have ever used. I would love to incorporate this in something, right? Or not exactly this, but a variation of this. And I have a little notebook that's just great mechanics that kind of got lost. Which is interesting, but most of the things that I think about, you know, the way I come into a lot of games is through theme. That said, as I've said many times, I'm very much setting agnostic, right? I don't love, you know, the proliferation of fantasy themes. It does nothing for me. It doesn't tell me not to play the game. It doesn't necessarily throw me for a curve and make me not want to play a game, but it's just not really crucial to it. But that's probably more what you said first, which is about 75% of the games we play, theme really doesn't matter. And I think that's what I'm responding to. I think for me, I love games where theme does matter. That's my two favorite games of all time are games in which theme matters tremendously. But I'm also able to play a game that just plays great, and it doesn't matter really what the theme is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Weirdly, my favorite themes are weird. I like weird themes. All right. I don't need to ever play another game with dragons and elves. I don't. There's just so many of them out there. It's just boring to me. But science fiction too, I don't have to play a game with starships that much anymore.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. I'm looking for something different. So container, I love the theme of container. And to some people they're like, wait, we're gonna play a game about what? About loading containers on ships and sending them out and bringing them back. But it's just such a fresh design. It's such a different theme, and I absolutely love it. You know, Demacher, the German parliamentary election system as a game design, I love it. I love the obscure design, the obscure themes, and how faithfully they are done in good games. I'll even say games like what's the game, The Bloody Inn. Right, based on a real story of these murderous innkeepers that decided that it was better to roll their patrons for all the money they had and then bury them in shallow graves out in the woods. They made a good game out of that. I love that theme, probably more than I do most other things. Now the most common theme in board games is historic, and even if it's not technically historic, right? I mean, you know. Things like Agricola, et cetera, fit into that category, even though they're not really historic per se, right? Right. Hanzo Titanica is technically historic, but not really, right? But that's the number one category. Then comes fantasy. Then comes science fiction. And I tend to like the outliers. I don't know. What about you?
Well, I think you bring up a very good point about unique themes being fresh in a world where, again, I think – most of the games that we like, these medium to heavy Euros, a lot of them are farming games, you know, Agricola, or some format of that, right?
Yep.
Or these, you know, historic, like basically Renaissance era, you know, European Renaissance,
yeah.
some spin on that. Princes of Florence comes to mind. Yeah. You know, we mentioned Lorenzo. You know, like how many, you know, boxes do we see of some Renaissance looking guy?
Yeah, you know, with his building arms games, folded
or something. Yeah, generally
you're building a society, you're building a city, you're building a town, right. You're building a castle, you're right.
Yep, exactly. So, and again, which lends itself to this whole idea of like being a complex, you know, interactive math puzzle, essentially, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I think when there is a unique, and I'm gonna mention some of the games on my list, like Galaris is my all-time favorite game, mm-hmm. and I've never seen, I still remember the moment when I didn't really get who Lacerda was as a designer, but I remember reading the announcement for Galaris. And again, from somebody who, you know, studied fine art, has a degree in it, you know, loves museums, you know, finding out that there was going to be a board game about basically being an international art dealer seemed really exciting. And and again, I can just look at a picture of a prototype or a game, and I guess part of what I'm doing is gauging how many resources seem to be in the pictures and just like, you know, be like, okay, that looks like my kind of game. It looks like an elder game that I would enjoy playing. And I definitely felt that. And it was just so great to like actually finally play it. And yeah, to this date, I mean, the game's been out there for a long time. And it's still like, but just my favorite game. I think it's so, I recently got back into it. Like, you know, in the last several months, I got to play on TTS a couple games of it. And it's just so good.
And there's, and when you think about it in those terms, there are so many games that haven't been made yet, right? Like
yeah.
Pick the most boring, generic thing you can think of, but mm-hmm. once you see what it takes, right? There used to be that thing on CBS This Morning where they would have these filmmakers, these documentary filmmakers, go and they would shoot just this footage of how Twinkies are made, right? And you mm-hmm. see all the steps in the process and it's beautiful. It's kind of amazing and fascinating. That's game design, right? Games can be like that. Games can be you are trying to do this. I could play a game about trash collection mm-hmm. and be absolutely fascinated by it if you did it right. If you did it like, well, actually, knowing where to put trash in a landfill, knowing how to separate out recyclables and all that sort of stuff is really hard. And how do you do that? How do you make that make that happen? I would be enthralled by designs like that. But I am not everybody.
Yeah. Well, I had the realization years ago that, you know, and again, there's this idea of system design, right? That basically any business you can break down into a game. And I've started to, you know, over the years, incorporate that a little bit into my consulting practice. And, you know, just also it, you know, loving games, it definitely helps me, you know, conceptualize things and really, you know, help out in conversations when people are trying to figure out a process or how to do something. You know, I've been really interested in you know, developing the video game industry in Africa, for instance.
Yeah.
Which is a huge undertaking, but it's just that there's so much opportunity. All of the developed world, including South America, has very developed video game industry.
You were a speaker at a conference in Ghana a couple of years back, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. It was the first video game conference in Africa, and it was in Ghana. I got invited over, and I basically came out with a strategy. I shared a strategy for what it would take, because it is the last emerging market on the planet for video games, and it's going to happen. I mean, Africans love games. It's a very young continent. It's amazing. It's like, what, 50% of the population is under 30. Mm-hmm. There are some hungry developers there. And there's just some very interesting obstacles that are preventing the market from emerging. And I've often thought about designing a, you know, basically bring video games or grow the video game industry in Africa board game, you know, to kind of map out what all the different things and then run it like a simulation.
Because once you realize that, oh, this is really hard, that becomes a game, right? The obstacles.
Yeah.
To doing something in real life become obstacles that you can gamify.
Exactly.
Which is really cool. I'm going to ignore the fact that you're ignoring the nearly absent Antarctic video game culture.
Okay.
You know, just I'm just saying there's one other market that has yet to be developed.
Okay.
But that's cool. So we've talked about games with amazing mechanics but a tacked on theme, games like Lorenzo Il Magnifico. Let's talk about the other side of that. Games that are heavily thematic, but the mechanics don't exactly support those themes. When I think of this side of the equation, I think of the PAX games. I think the PAX games are amazing, right? PAX Porphyriana being the first one is a game about, you know, the Mexican a period of Mexican history where the Mexican-American border was very much in flux, and who was in power was constantly shifting and constantly changing over a period of time. Actually, it was a period where it wasn't. It was the Pax Porfiriana. It was the Porfiriana regime in Mexico. But there was always the threat of it being toppled. Really fascinating, and the game teaches you a lot about history by looking at the cards and understanding how the game plays. But the mechanics of the game are there are cards out there, and the cards represent certain things, and you're paying money to draft these cards and then play them in front of you. It's not what I would call a mechanics that really feed the theme in a way that really, really supports it. You're playing through history, but the game doesn't directly mimic history in a certain way. You know, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're speaking to or pointing to is this idea of, you know, part of mechanisms in a game is the actions that you take.
Yes.
Right. And so I think this speaks to the idea of like user experience, right? And it's like, what you're doing in the game space, does it feel like what the theme is expressing in the game?
Yes, yes. Do I feel like I'm doing what the game is about?
Right, right. And it's always a level of abstraction.
Sure.
But again, does it, in terms of user experience, does it feel like that?
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, yeah.
Understood. Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair. So for me, you know, when you're talking about mechanics and theme, and a lot of the time is when I talk about it, I talk about simulation and game, right? And I think about it in those terms, like how well is it simulating something, an experience, which seems to me to be very thematic. It's very much about what is the theme of the game versus how well does the game play as a game. And it's really hard to do both well. You know what I mean? Right. It's almost always a, wow, that is so thematic. It's a good game, but not a great game. But the theme is, you know, and I think of games like Here I Stand. I think a lot of war games and quasi-war games can be in that realm where, wow, it really taught me so much about that period of history, but wasn't exactly the most engrossing game. It's good, but it's not incredible. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Should we get to our tops? What do you want to do?
Yeah. Just one more thing I wanted to say is that sometimes there's this feeling of, you know, the mechanics are matching the theme. Like you're feeling like what the theme is, like what you're doing is matching up well.
Yeah.
But it's just not fun.
Yeah.
Right. Or it's not enjoyable. Or we've, you know, I think over the last year or two, each one of the game brainers has at some point we've been playing something where we're like, you know what, like, I don't know if I'm having fun with this game. Like, this feels more like work, or this is stressing me out, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely a factor that comes into play.
And by the way, we may have to put an asterisk on everything we've reviewed in 2020 and say that when times are back to a slightly more normal state, maybe, and when our nerves are less frayed than they are currently, we might have a very different perception about what is fun and what isn't, right? We may be in a more fragile state than we sometimes realize or can acknowledge.
Yeah. I think that's a good point.
Which is interesting. The thing I'm taking away most from this discussion is what you said about turning an African video game industry into a board game, and just the idea that any process, right, any system can be gamified, and the struggles of what we try to do in real life is great fodder and great material for games. I think that's fantastic. And, you know, when you talk about gamification in the educational space, I think that's really, really key, right? There's so many of the world's problems that we are trying to educate ourselves about would do well to be put into game form, right?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's something definitely where my career is headed in terms of like what I'm doing in business is basically combining my expertise and love of game design and education or training, right? And so I'm really starting to focus my company now on XR, if you will, or augmented reality, virtual reality training simulations.
Sure.
You know, I had this kind of aha moment where, you know, I basically realized that doing these simulations in terms of business, like everybody needs to train people. And then, I mean, this has become even more important. Like, how do you do it safely mm-hmm. and economically, like with what we're dealing with?
Sure.
And it's a great now that there's, you know, a platform out there like the Oculus Quest, mm-hmm. which is plug and play. It's you know, relatively cheap. I mean, I think the Quest 2 is, like, I just saw for like $299. It's affordable.
Yeah.
It all of a sudden opens up the doors to, you know, all types of like applications for training.
Amazing. Amazing. All right, here we go. These are going to be our top five games that blend mechanics and theme well. Let's start at our number five, but first let's do honorable. Do you have any honorable mentions? I have a few.
I don't.
Here we go. Number one honorable mention, Jaws. We just talked about it in Games of the Brain, but man, it is a game that definitely, I think Prospero Hall comes theme first, right? Because they come with a experience that they want to gamify. Mm-hmm. I think it does a great job. And then Francis Drake and the companion piece, Lignum, the heavier version of that, I think are both really great in the sense that they both have this phase in which you are making hard choices in terms of how much you are equipping yourself to go on this journey, to do this task. In one case, the task is raiding the Spanish Main as Francis Drake. And in another case, you are you're trying to chop down trees and get the timber to the sawmill and to work your way through the timber industry. And the way both of those games have those two parts and the hard decisions in each of them just feels tremendously thematic. It makes me feel like I am doing what the game is designed to do at every stage, at every step of the way. And the decisions that I'm making, I could easily see in Francis Drake, a ship's captain making those tough decisions between do I go for this or do I go for that? I can't have, you know, my ship can't be everything and I can't do everything. What am I going to focus on this journey into the Caribbean? So I love it. Absolutely love it. Mm. What is your number five?
Actually, I do have an honorable mention. I just thought of it. I know we reviewed the game before. It's one of my favorites. New Amsterdam.
It's
incredibly thematic with the whole Native American moving them, down the river. Yeah.
Heartbreaking, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And my list, just want to quantify a little bit. I focus, except for one game, Galaris, I focused mostly on games that came out last year. So this is kind of like a more, whoa, you know, fresh five as opposed to all time list.
All right. Well, I'm doing all time. So that's going to be a good cross pollination there. Awesome. What's your number five?
Yeah. Number five is Bonfire. I would say the one of the new Stefan Fells that came out this year. This is a case where I feel like, and I've heard people, you know, be kind of critical about it, but I feel like it's a very Feldian game. There's a lot of like interlocking mechanisms, you know, a bit of point salad, although I feel like there's certain things that you have to do to really be competitive in the game. Mm-hmm. But I think it has a very unique fantasy story that I feel like he crafted to help explain what's going on with the mechanics. But for me, it really makes sense. Like he basically created this world that fits with the mechanisms that he designed, and it works for me. I feel like it's a very good marriage, and it just makes a lot of sense.
It's really interesting because when I think Stefan Feld, I think amazing design theme could not be farther from his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. You're about to.
No, say. I think that's usually the case.
Yeah.
Right. And I think again, for whatever reason, I don't know if he did it himself or if he had help, but this very intricate story about these guardians and, you know, lighting these bonfires and bringing light back to the world. And, you know, it's like a very kind of deep, you know, fantasy story that he created. But I feel like it really goes together and makes a lot of sense in the game.
It's pretty great. I love it. My number five is Panamax. And whenever I say the word Panamax, I think of Paul doing the moment anyone says Panamax, say, Panamax! Panamax!
I refer to this game as Panamax.
It's tough. It's hard. But guess what? It is tremendously thematic. If you were a shipping company and you had to deal with ships moving through the Panama Canal, which is, 60-70% of all shipments in the world at some point traverse the Panama Canal, something along those lines, or at least shipping, it's amazing. And the game really does a great job of creating the issues and the complex problems of getting your ship in position and moving it along and dealing with traffic jams and all that sort of stuff. And I think it really feels like I am managing a shipping company that is trying to traverse the Panama Canal and bring the biggest profits to my company that I can. Man. You know, much like I was saying about, you know, I like to see different themes. This is a very different theme. This is a theme that is loving. Could it be more thematic? I'm sure that it could be. I'm sure that they could get into the weeds in terms of how these things really work. And at some point, it is abstracted. It is, okay, my ship is pushing your ship along and all that sort of stuff. And that'll make sense. But Panamax is a very interesting theme, and the mechanics work very, very well within it. You're number four, Elder.
My number four is a little game called Perseverance. This is basically kind of like a version of Jurassic Park, I guess, in a way. you crash land. It's a very intricate story.
This is the Castaway about Chronicles.
What's that?
Castaway Chronicles. Yes.
Yep. Exactly. Where you crash land on an island that's inhabited by these dinosaurs. Maybe there's a time travel thing. I can't quite remember, but somehow, you know, you're, oh, it's also, it's like Jurassic Park meets, Lost.
Ooh.
I think it's the concept. Ooh. Right. Which would make, it seems like it could make a pretty cool movie, right?
Kind of the land that time forgot.
Yeah. Or Netflix show or something like that.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know what I mean? Yeah, probably would be better episodic, which actually the board game has several episodes, right? Like there's like a whole another board after you've established, you know, your colony or whatever on this island, right?
Right.
But basically you play a person who is a leader and you have these helpers or workers, but it's semi-collaborative. Excuse me, and that there's these dinosaurs that are attacking you, and you have to basically, you know, like Lost, you have to basically take scraps from your crashed, you know, vessel that got you there, and create this, you know, camp. And at the same time, you have to defend against the encroaching dinosaurs that are coming. Just very, very thematic. Again, I feel like they probably did come up with this story concept first and then, you know, came up with mechanics that would match it. Mm-hmm. But with the minis and the worker placement and, you know, the kind of intrigue that's inherent in the game and the decisions that you have to make. It feels like this is a very good marriage of mechanics and story or theme.
Interesting. I purposely left story style games out of the mix. So it's interesting that you put one in there, because by that definition, you know, the Gloomhavens of the world and the Kingdom Death Monster and all those, you know, those blend mechanics and theme very well, but they're kind of almost a side issue, right? They're kind of almost a different type of game. But that's interesting. Perseverance, I haven't played it yet, so I'm dying to check it out.
Yeah, it's really good. It's funny because I only played it a few times and I had a great time, and for some reason just have not been able to get it back on the table.
I think we know the reason. My number four is very similar to your number one. Your number one is Gallerist. My number four is Modern Art. The Reiner Knizia bidding game could not be simpler. We are gallery owners, and we get our hands on paintings by certain artists. There are five artists in total, and we are putting them up for auction. And there are four different ways the auctions can go, and at the end of the game, whoever earns the most money wins. And when, at the end of each of the three rounds, whenever one work of art sells the most, that work of art becomes inherently more valuable in future rounds, which is just, it feels, it's such a simple game. It is such an elegant little design by Reiner Knizia. And yet, when you're playing it, I completely feel like I'm a wheeler dealer in the art world.
Mm.
That is my number four. What is your number three, Elder?
My number three is the new Dune game, Dune Imperium, which is based on the, you know, the reboot movie that's going to be coming out, although they used the art assets from the game. So again, very story driven. And I, again, this has been a super hot game on Tabletop Simulator, like the server that I'm on, TTS Club. I mean, you put up Dune Imperium and you'll have players in moments. Like, you'll never be waiting around to get a game of this off. And I kind of don't really understand it. I think it's an interesting game. Again, for me, I'm not a big conflict guy. It has some resources, but it doesn't have, you know, like 13, 14. So I guess those are two for me. But one thing I do really appreciate about the game is just how thematic it is. I mean, it just really, really feels like, you know, it's all about duking it out on the planet surface, this like nonstop war of these factions. All of the houses, you know, have some mechanism that make them recognizable in the lore or the IP, you know, how difficult it is to get water and how important spice is. I mean, I just think, you know, pound for pound, you know, hitting all of the things that are important about the theme, the mechanisms really, you know, get that across.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. My number three is Pandemic. Any version of Pandemic, Pandemic Legacy even more so, but Pandemic is one of these games that once you play it the very first time, you immediately understand it. Oh, these cubes are the disease, and the disease is getting worse. The epidemic is growing, and once you get enough cubes in a city, if you get another cube, it expands to all of the cities that it touches. Everywhere that there's a train or plane or whatever connecting, it is going to spread to those cities. And the efforts to eradicate it are so clear, so evident. It's as though it should be higher on this particular list, because the way you play the game is so connected to the theme.
Yeah.
Really amazing. You know, and maybe why it is so incredibly popular. Maybe it really exploded out there because it's interesting to, and by the way, very interesting theme, very different theme than everything else. You are virus hunters that are trying to stop an epidemic in its tracks, and boy, oh boy, can we relate to that right now. But it is a great theme, and the mechanics 100% mirror that.
Yeah.
What is
absolutely
What is your number two?
Well, it was the game that we reviewed today, which we've already talked a lot about, Darwin's Journey. Again, great marriage of mechanics and theme.
Totally agree. I think it is very thematic. I said in the review, it plays very much like you are on the Beagle, or you're on another sister ship to the Beagle and exploring. Mm-hmm. My number two is my number two game of all time, and my number one, I'll tell you, is my number one game of all time. My number two is Twilight Struggle. When I am playing Twilight Struggle, I feel as though I am Henry Kissinger, or whoever you want to say you are. I am working to foil the Soviet threat, or I am working to drown the capitalist pigs in their own blood. I am trying to... My hand of cards are things that are about to happen, things that could happen. And if they're my events, I can choose whether or not to force them upon the world or to hold off. And if they're enemy events, I am responding to them. I'm playing them at a certain time in order to respond to them and to act against them. And it could not feel more like I am right here in the events of our time, and I have just a limited amount of ability to control and shape them to my will. Absolutely love Twilight Struggle. Twilight Imperium, I mean, Imperial Struggle is one of those games that definitely could be on this list. I just haven't played it quite enough to say for sure. But anyway, that's my number two. What is your number one, as if I have to guess?
Exactly. And, you know, number one game of all time, Gallerist. Just love how, this game plays and how you really do have the experience of being this international art dealer. It's very important that you're discovering these new artists, this idea that you, when you discover them, you make this kind of deal with them, that you will get, they will make a piece for you or create a piece of art, and you'll be able to get it at that initial price, you know, but you can only make that deal with one artist at a time. That one of your major resources in the game is your influence, which is expressed in like how much money you have or have access to, because you can spend your influence for money versus your kind of like popularity. So your kind of network or your connections with these celebrities, which you can, you know, invite, give free tickets to come into your gallery, and they will, you know, attract others or give you more influence. That there's this kind of international market where you have to kind of place these bids for. I mean, all these things, you know, kind of swirling around together in this. You know, just very interesting, you know, anchor of mechanics that just really give you this great feeling and winds up making a great game. And again, like, this goes to your point of like being very unique, you know, like modern art is, you know, very specific, and it's just about that kind of bidding mechanic.
Yep.
But this game, just Gallerist, takes it to a whole other level where, you know, you have all these other things. You're promoting your artist. You know, you actually have a gallery. You can sell pieces, but you have to have a contract. I mean, it's just like, it just kind of hits all of those things. And who knows if, like, you know, it actually feels anything like this if you really, like, if you actually have that job of being an international art dealer. But it sure of hell seems like it, you know, as an abstraction. Like, it just seems like it just really nails it.
And I don't think it matters if it's really what it feels like. What matters is that it feels like it's what it feels like.
Exactly.
I think, you know, thinking about it, Vito Lacerda is one of those designers that does seem to design theme for us. I mean, certainly CO2. Yeah. Came theme first. I think Vinos came theme first. I think a lot of his designs come from that point of view. I think Lisboa as well. So I think he's one of those designers that is very, very concentrated on theme and then designing mechanisms to fit that theme.
Yeah. Yep. On Mars as well. You know, even the Getaway game. I can't remember the name of it right now, but. Yeah,
it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yep.
My number one is my number one game of all time. Mm-hmm. Just like yours. D-Mocker is, we could say it. It's the greatest game that has ever been made or ever will be made. Other people, they don't want to feel like they're just glomming on to mine. So they come up with their own choice. But we all know that it's in parentheses and next to it is D-Mocker for right. everyone. Everyone's number one game. Yeah. It is so amazing how the game takes 4 hours plus to play. It just does. I mean, maybe people can play it faster, but I don't think it should play faster than that because it involves negotiation and argument and all this sort of stuff. You're in a political campaign. We play a variant. It's not a variant. It's just a re-theme, which is set in the American presidential primary system, where mm-hmm. it is multiple candidates vying to be the candidate that their party is going to put up against the current president in the next presidential election. And it works wonderfully in that sense. It works 100% perfectly. But there are so many – it's an older game. It's from the 1980s. And it has so many – it's got that old design where there are 12 phases to each round, right? There are 7 rounds, and this phase is this, and this phase is that. But because the theme is so tied to everything, it's seamless. And everybody, whoever played it with, has said, I can't believe that it is 1 a.m. I feel like it should be only 10 at night. Mm-hmm. It just goes so quickly. The idea of the states that have their own issues and their concerns, and you're trying to change the public opinion in those places to come closer to your own party platform, or you're changing your own platform. The way that you have limited resources, you have these important people in your party that can go and campaign for you, but you can only use them once. And where are you gonna put them? Where are you gonna have them make their big splash? And what are they gonna do? How are they gonna change public opinion? How are they gonna change the number of votes that you're getting? Absolutely fascinating. And in terms of theme, one of the most different themes out there. There's very, very few political games that are out there. Maybe because the best has already been done. That's it. That's our top five blending of mechanics and theme. And didn't even mean to do it, but we did the recent blending of themes and we did the classic blending of themes and mechanics. Elder, do you have time for a board game sommelier?
Sure, absolutely.
Let's do it.
Sometimes a player just got to know which game should stay. Which game should go? Which to play with mama, madame, abu? You got to tell me, monsieur, just what to do. Want to make an impression, but I can't get far. As my 50th play of Agricola. A million games. Show me the way to the master, the game sommelier.
Now all I can hear is Maddie singing over it last time. How? We're almost at 100 episodes. How do you not know the lyrics to it by now? I mean, he messed it up. He had some of them, but come on, buddy. We expect better from you. Maybe it's because you barely play it anymore. But there we go. That is it. We have a board game sommelier from our Discord group. We have from Ocean Blue said, I had a funny thing happen a while back when the Microturns episode aired, where I had brought Race Arcana for my cousins to try. They had previously only played Dominion, and the thing they immediately remarked on at the start was that it feels like you're just doing so little on your turn compared to Dominion, where you can play a ton of cards per turn if you get villages. By the way, not a good strategy. What are good suggestions for light to medium card-based board games where you can create strong combos that happen at once? So we're talking about combos in card-based games. You got anything on this one? This is a hard one.
Yeah. I'm thinking, racking my brain here. I don't know if I have one that I can think of.
I have three suggestions. I have three, but it was hard. This was a tough one. So I'm going to go. Number one, the Carl Chudik classic Innovation.
Oh, yeah.
Innovation is a really, really interesting game. And it is definitely one of those games where I play a card, I do its actions, and it all of a sudden, what your board that had all of these things going on has been ravaged and destroyed. It has a lot of very interesting chain reactions that can happen in that game. Hmm. Second is a game, a fairly recent game called Gizmos. Gizmos is a really, really interesting, I guess, when we talk about these sorts of things, Gizmos came out in 2018. And the idea is that you're at a science fair and you're trying to make your biggest, craziest creation, right? And you have four actions. You can put a card in, you know, take a card into your archive. You can take a marble from the 3D marble dispenser. You can build one machine, or you can research and draw more cards. And it ends up being one of these things that. It's kind of the entire game's design is to make this happens, then that happens, then that happens, then that happens. And it's really quite fun as far as that kind of game goes. So if that's the kind of game that your friends like, Gizmos might be the best choice for them. And that comes from another game, or well, I'm not sure if it comes from it, but there's Potion Explosion. Which came out in 2015, which works in a similar area. Potion Explosion, you are, what are they, alchemists? Yes, you're alchemists, uh-huh. And it also has the marbles, and you're trying to get the right ingredients to put together these potions. And once again, it's one of these things where you're trying to create these chain reactions where this, begets this, and has a big result. It's one of those things that I really enjoyed, when I was first playing Dominion, I really enjoyed the idea that, well, I play the village, which is going to let me do this, which is going to let me play another village, which is going to let me do this and this and this. Later found out, no, it's not really a good way to win the game. But there is something about creating a chain reaction and seeing seeing a grand plan come together for one big turn, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a fun feeling, like just the opportunity in the game of having a really big turn and like building up to it and planning for it is a great thing and kind of tricky to pull off, I think.
Yeah, yeah, there aren't enough games that do that well. I think it is a very hard design challenge for sure. So mm-hmm. Innovation, Gizmos, and Potion Explosion, Ocean Blue.
So I've come up with a few now that I had a little bit to think about it.
Do it!
And again, I don't know this first one. I don't know if there's combos, but again, specifically a card game that might fit the bill here is It's a Wonderful World. I don't know if you played that at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think really the combinations are more about, you know, what resources you can get to the bigger cards and then what your specific
focus.
What your specific goals are as far as like scoring big points at the end.
Yeah, and there are card effects that will do terrible things to the other players and sometimes combinations where by playing this one card suddenly I activate this other much larger, much harder to get into play card, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Another one is La Granja.
Oh, interesting. You're right.
Yeah, so that's so much about these unique cards and the synergy of having these cards work together and, you know, whether you're going to be using the powers or not. That's like really, really key to that game.
Yeah, that's a board game as opposed to a card-based game, but it is a board game that has a card element that is very, very crucial and does a lot of interesting things to the game for sure. Oh, great.
Yep. Yep, and then similarly, the last one is, which I'd love to get this game back on the table again. This might even be a future review, possibly. I don't know. But Energy Empire, Manhattan Project.
Yep, we just talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely one of those games where the game encourages you to specialize in certain cards. And when you take an action in that specialty and you got a bunch of the cards, that rattles off this really nice chain effect where you can get a bunch of resources and have a really huge turn.
So true. I love that game. I haven't played it in a while. When we get back to in-person playing, I would love to play that with you again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Ocean Blue, that's some great, great suggestions. Hopefully that is helpful to you. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/GameBrainPod, a Facebook group and a Discord channel. If you are not part of our Facebook group or Discord channel, join it. It's a lot of fun. There's always something interesting going on there. And please, get us more of those board game sommelier questions. We really do love them. Elder, it is always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope very much that you get out of the frigid Northeast and back to the sunny, warm confines of Southern California, where you have many people that will love you and miss you until you come back.
Yes, I appreciate that, and I'm very much looking forward to coming back and still looking forward to that glorious day where we'll be sitting down across the table from each other in real life and playing some really cool games.
Totally, totally, totally looking forward to that. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson and Tom Donnelly. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. More on Daedalus at GameBrainPod.com. You can also reach us by email at contact@GameBrainPod.com or on Twitter at GameBrain_pod. Thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us. And go out and play some games with friends online or virtually make some friends with games. Thank you.